Okay, so yes, indeed. So this is my outline. Let me just start by introducing why we are interested in global quenches. So what is a global quench? We start with the ground state of our system and inject some uniform energy density in a very short time interval. And so I imagine some strongly coupled system. So one point functions, for example, the energy density, entropy density, will reach their equilibrium value in a time that I will denote by T log of order 1 over T. But non-local observables or multi-point functions that are separated by large distances take a longer time to equilibrate of order R, where R is the characteristic distance. So this is the possibly the simplest setting where you can study equilibration in a quantum system. So what happens to entanglement entropy? It starts out as an area law, which we can imagine that only degrees of freedom near the boundary of our region, which I will denote by sigma and is drawn by purple, are entangled with the outside. So we get area law, and we wait some time of order r, where r is the radius of this region, and then we expect to reach thermal entropy density times the volume of volume law, and the typical point inside is entangled with the outside. So this orange region covers all of our region. So how do we calculate the time evolution of entanglement entropy? In 2D, we have exact diagonalization, and we also have the famous work of Cardi-Calabrese in CFTs. In higher dimensions, the most flexible tool is holography, where a global quench is dual to black hole formation in the bulk. In the simplest setting, you can just throw in massless particles, which will propagate along the null ray and form a black hole. And then, using the HRT prescription that I won't write down, you can just obtain the time evolution of entanglement entropy. And in any dimension, you typically get such a curve. So it starts quadratically, just like in Tadashi's talk for the minimal volumes. Then there is a parametrically large region where you have approximately linear evolution. And that's going to be the focus of my talk. And then you have saturation. So this linear region, I will characterize by this velocity, which I will refer to as tsunami velocity. And then it's multiplied by the thermal entropy density and the area of the entangling surface. Okay. So a cartoon advocated by Liu and Su is that you have a tsunami wave front starting from the boundary. It propagates invert, and these orange degrees of freedom get entangled with the outside, whereas the inside still remains unentangled. And as this wave front propagates inside, you reach equilibrium. So this cartoon explains the feature that this linear behavior is proportional to the area of the entangling surface. It also explains that it's linear, and the rest you can just calculate. I think it's fair to say that it's natural from an evolution by a local Hamiltonian. Okay, so what do we want to say about this? First of all, we want to answer the question, how fast can entanglement be generated? So for that, we have to compare different regions and different systems. The way to do that is to divide the time derivative of entanglement entropy by the area of the entangling region to get rid of this factor in this formula, and also by the thermal entropy density, which we can imagine to be something like a count of the number of degrees of freedom. So that way, we get some quantity, which is dimensions velocity, and we expect that it should be constrained by causality. And indeed, in holography, it is constrained or bounded by a number, which is given here. The form is not very important. And this is actually saturated if you do a quench where you don't insert charge density, just neutral. Throw in neutral matter and form a black hole. And then this poses the natural question if this is some bound similar to the viscosity bound or the recent Lyapunov exponent bound or the Fast-Kremlin conjecture, which all arose from holography and have a pretty established status. So our question is whether for all quantum systems, relativistic quantum systems, this R is bounded by this V. So I won't be able to answer this question, but at least provide some hints towards I will just describe some attempts to try to attack this question. Okay, so I will start by a simple free particle model, which is a generalization of Cardi and Calabrese's picture. So they had a picture in 1+1 dimensions. They say that we, by this global quench, we inject EPR pairs into our system, and they start out from the same point, propagate without interacting with each other in different directions. And the rule is that if one member ends up in region A, the other outside, then you get entanglement, otherwise you don't. In higher dimensions, this light cone, which consisted of two points, now becomes a sphere, so that's drawn by red. The part of the light cone that falls inside the region is denoted by double line, and by these assumptions, you can sum over the entropies of the different light cones because they don't talk to each other. So this is this formula. Mu is the entropy coming from one light cone, and it's a functional of the shape and size of this region on a light cone. So this is the assumption. And then if we want to get a good entropy from this, then this mu has to obey the purity, strong subadditivity constraints, just like entropy. To get thermalization, so this volume law behavior, what you need is that for small regions on the light cone, so the measure of them divided by their normalized area has to go in the limit of small regions to the thermal entropy density. And you can understand that from looking at this formula. At late times, the light cone is huge, so only a small part of it falls inside sigma. And so you know that you only need the small region behavior of this mu. And if you do the calculation, the proportional factor just comes out to be one. And from these three, you can actually prove that this mu is bounded by the following function. So it's the minimum of the normalized area of the of this incident part of the light cone and its complement. Yes? Yes, but these
the bulk part is trivially saturated.
Yeah, so I'm sorry, I didn't explain that this delta means that we subtract the vacuum contributions. So because we get entropy by adding up these mu contributions and because they don't talk to each other, this is like an independent quantum system for every light cone. So if we just pick one light cone, it's an entropy so is the entanglement entropy between this part of the light cone and the rest of the light cone.
Do you agree with the delta as the satisfied
quantum? I agree, but because the volume law has this parameter S pH in front of it, you can ask what happens to the terms in the strong subadditivity inequality proportional to this STH, and you can think that you're tuning that, and from that argument you can argue that basically this part also has to. I mean, in a real quantum system, of course, you cannot separate the area lobe from this term, but in this toy model, you can think of that. Other question? Okay, so let me give you a flavor of how you get this linear growth. So for early times, the curvature of sigma can be neglected. So this is this region after local equilibration, but before you reach the length scale of the curvature. So you have just a half plane, or like a half space, sorry. And so the inner part of light cones will be spherical caps. So you can do this integral more explicitly in terms of the measure of spherical caps. This xi again is the area of the normalized is the normalized area. And then you can just rescale your integration variable to get t out. So it's explicitly linear. You get this a sigma, and I just chose to separate this thermal entropy density and say that this thing is just the tsunami velocity. So let me emphasize that this mu is determined by the initial state. So you imagine that you injected some energy and you created some entanglement pattern. And in this model, that persists for all times. And correspondingly, this tsunami velocity is state dependent. OK, so just to get some familiarity, let's just go through some examples of what this mu can be. So the most straightforward example is the generalization of Cardi-Calabrese, where you have EPR pairs. You just count how many EPR pairs are such that one member is inside, one member is outside, and we assume that they propagate back to back. So it's clear that the number will be proportional to the ratio of the infalling part of the light cone, at least for regions which are contained in one half of the light cone. For larger regions, it's more complicated. You can also assume that you have two M particles entangled in a GAZ pattern. From that, you get this functional form. And you can also talk about something that is inspired by the Page result for small subsystems. So you can say that if the incident part is small, then you say that the entropy of it, you take the smaller subsystem and the entropy is proportional to the size of the smaller subsystem. And as I showed on the previous slide, this actually bounds all possible mus. So if you want to get saturation through this, then this is the maximum mu you can choose. You would have thought to start with that you can choose an arbitrary mu. Instead, it's bounded by this. Okay, and from this result, you will get a bound on this tsunami velocity in this class of models. Because we had an integral over this cap function, now we can bound this cap function point by point by this thing. So I get just this integral. I can do this integral. I get this result. And what we find is that this result is smaller than what you get from holography. So what does this mean? This means that in strongly coupled systems, entanglement propagates faster than what is possible from this free streaming. So interactions must play a role. So this was the quantitative part of my talk. And then I will describe some attempts that have varied success for including interaction. So yes.
Can you distinguish between interactions versus the fact that the holographic ground state is already very entangled? I mean, you could have a free system where you have a lot of entanglement to start with.
But you know that the holographic system to start with only has area law entanglement. So you know that it's not very entangled. It basically, it satisfies the starting conditions. What it doesn't satisfy is that through maybe scatterings of these light cones or interactions of these light cones, maybe you can generate entanglement.
I wanted to ask something similar. Suppose you start the quench at 2 points, it's going to rather than one.
No, sorry, I start this. So the quench I'm talking about is injecting uniform energy density. So it's not a local quench, it's happening everywhere. So it's translationally invariant.
Okay, I see.
So yes. Okay. So let's go through what one scattering event does to the entanglement, and then we will generalize it to infinitely many scatterings. So let me go through this B, C, D situation first, which are very easy. So we assume a scattering between particles 2, 3, because they are at the same point, and we have a local theory. And that we just take that into account by a unitary rotation on the 2, 3 Hilbert space.
Excuse me. So how do you know that actually there's no three particle processes that are being created by this quench?
Three particle entanglement or three particle?
So here you assume that somehow the quasi particles are just two particles, but you could also have processes.
No, so that was the example of this GHZ where I had two M, where M is an integer, so like say four entangled particles, and that actually just decreased the speed instead of increasing it. So the more complicated pattern of entanglement you have in the initial state, you actually decrease the speed instead of increasing. Okay, so in this situation, say initially one and two were entangled similarly to three and four by translation invariance, and then two, three scattered, but one wasn't touched by this scattering process, so of course entanglement doesn't change. This picture is just a complement of that. If we exchange A and A complement, then we get the same picture as in B. In here, we have 2, 3 scattering, but it's just the rotation of the Hilbert space that is inside A. So it's a change of basis in HA, so of course this doesn't affect entanglement, whereas this A and E scenarios change entanglement. So what we learn from this for systems which have a mean three path a lot smaller than the entangling region is that scatterings that happen in the red and green regions corresponding to the path domain of dependence of A and A complement don't do anything. So we can just forget about them and only concentrate on scatterings that happen in the white regions. In particular, we can just focus on particles that start out here and here, or for later time. So this is for one interval in two dimensions. So you get disconnected pieces that don't talk to each other, so you can treat them separately. Or for later times, you just have one region where particles originate, and then they scatter with their friends who end up outside. We just want to give some rule how to count the effective scatterings that created entanglement and in the end give you the entanglement between A and A bar. So because there's a loss of the memory of the initial state through these infinitely many scatterings, the best measure we could come up with is just to count how many particles ended up in region A or in region A bar that participated in effective scattering. And so we use the same random pure state measure inspired by this smaller subsystem entropy to give a rule for what the entanglement entropy is. So for every disconnected component of this M, which is just a region without these path domain of dependencies, we minimize between the number of particles that end up in A and in A bar. We add them up together and see what we get. So this is actually, if you do some elementary high school geometry, equivalent to a recently proposed formula to reproduce multi-interval behavior of holographic entanglement entropy. So this formula was proposed, but it actually doesn't work for more than two intervals. It gives an upper bound. It, for example, for three intervals, it can exhibit jumps, which you can show that violates strong sub additivity. So this is just too much hand waving. This prescription is, we expect it gives an upper bound. It, for example, when these two regions join at some time, it might connect regions that didn't have enough time to equilibrate. So you cannot apply this maximally chaotic measure for those degrees of freedom. So that's approximately where we got. And this also gives tsunami velocity equal to one in higher dimensions, so larger than what you get from holography. But again, this model has many deficiencies, but at least it's some attempt to incorporate interactions. So this is what I have to say about trying to incorporate interactions. And if there are no questions, I will go on to a simple proof of that this tsunami velocity is actually bounded by the speed of light. So I said in the introduction that we expect that in relativistic systems, it's bound, it's related to causality, and it indeed is. This proof was also in a similar setup, was also obtained by in unpublished work by Hartmann. So because the tsunami velocity is independent of what region you consider, you can consider just a half space. So in this region, I suppress the transverse directions. So I just consider one half space and another one, and I have translation invariance. So this W at t and W at some later time. So time is going up, and they are connected by a light-like region X. And I will use these two facts. One is that the entropy of W union X is equal to the entropy of this, and this follows from relativistic invariance, because entropy is the property of a causal diamond in relativistic theory. And for a half space, we are always in the linear regime after local equilibration. So I can use this inequality, or this equality. And then we consider the mutual information between this guy and this guy. So I just wrote the definition here. I use this equality for this guy and the linear regime condition for this one. And I get this final formula. Then if I use the non-negativity of mutual information, meaning that this is greater than or equal to zero, then I get this bound on the tsunami velocity. So all we have to show that V is smaller than or equal to one, is that the entropy of this guy, which is an infinitesimal with light-like strip, is equal to thermal entropy density, the area of a plane times delta t. And that can be shown from the monotonicity of mutual information. So we consider this figure and the mutual information between A prime and B prime. That has to be smaller than or equal to A and B, mutual information of A and B. And we take these sizes to be infinitesimal, two times the time interval that we have there. So that's the setup. We write out the mutual information of A prime, B prime. And then it's bounded by IAB. But because these guys have already reached thermal equilibrium, they don't have mutual information in this sense that Mukund asked about. So this subtracted mutual information. So from that, we learn that this mutual information is also zero. And from that, we can just derive this equality. So we learn that the tsunami velocity is bounded by the speed of light. Now, of course, this proof works for non-isotropic systems. So for example, if you took 1D chains next to each other, which don't talk to each other, you get the tsunami velocity is 1. So this proof better gave you that result. If somehow you manage to incorporate isotropy in this proof, which I don't know how to do, maybe you could get a lower speed. So the question remains whether the holographic bound that you find is really a universal bound, or whether it can be surpassed by some strongly interacting system. Yeah. Thank you.
Is there a way to take the interacting picture and sort of turn off the interaction to get back to the thinking?
Yeah, so that would correspond to increasing the mean free path of particles. And so somehow we found that what is easy to be treated is the non-interacting or the infinitely many scatterings thing. I mean, in words, I mean, you could try to come up with some Boltzmann-type equation for entanglement. Of course, it wouldn't be a local thing. You would have to keep track of particles that have met and scattered throughout their lifetime. And currently, I don't know how to do it, but I think it's very interesting to try to do it.
So I guess, about these conditional entropy inequalities that I mentioned in a while ago, is it possible that those give you tighter bounds than SSA? Because you do show on your SSA slide that your mutual information has to be zero.
Yes.
So I think there are conditional entropy inequalities that are stronger than SSA if the mutual information is guaranteed to be zero.
I mean, one nice thing would come from, I don't know if I would be able to answer your question, but one thought is that you have this mutual information. So if you reorganize this equation into VE equal to basically 1 minus the mutual information between these two regions, and somehow you could get some nice bound or lower bound on what this mutual information is between this guy and this guy. So if this is bounded from below, then you get a decrease in the tsunami velocity. In the free models, we did the calculation and you get back exactly the right tsunami velocity there, because the free models in higher dimension give you some mutual information between these two guys. Maybe interactions can decrease it, but I don't know if they can eliminate the mutual information completely.
Okay, no more questions then.
Thank you.